Hello and welcome to this week's Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by Phil Oakley. How are you doing, Phil?
I'm all right, thank you, John.
Excellent. Just you and me today.
Yeah.
After the excitement of last week.
Indeed.
Good. It was good.
No, I really enjoyed it.
Really nice to see Peter, get Peter Higgins on the podcast. And there was lots of warm response to that on Twitter, which is great.
Yeah.
It's going to be rather subdued today, I think. Are we feeling it? Are we feeling it, Phil?
I think we're all right.
We're all right.
All right, yeah.
What are we going to talk about? I think we're going to talk about Ocado.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about Ocado. I think my column this week is about sort of warning signs, that kind of thing, and how you don't need to be wise with hindsight. You can actually see red flags, mind your eye signs are often there long in advance of a share price blow up.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about Cineworld as well, which might actually fall into that category. Let's start with your column, because actually, before I'd read your column, I started to write on the same subject, because we've had a number of accounting problems at several companies this week. We had Ted Baker issued some horrible guidance to the market about an accounting issue. M&C Saatchi, Eddie Stobart, there's something odd going on there. But let's talk about Ted, because this is the one that you spotted, and actually you and Algie spotted at the same time in the issue of the 26th of July. And it was a stock issue that you had both spotted by interrogating the report and accounts.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's fair to say that this stock issue has been building for years at Ted Baker. If you haven't looked at it, you won't have seen it. The rate of stock build in this company is, you know, very alarming. And just to explain what I'm going on about is that, you know, one of the key sort of warning signs, particularly for retailers but also manufacturers, is you look at the ratio of stock levels to revenue or sales. And generally, a growing business needs more stock for various reasons, in terms of having enough to sell so they don't go short and that kind of thing, building up. So a rising level of stock as the business grows is not generally a concern. It's when the stock levels grow faster than the sales levels that we can begin to have problems.
So we're not looking at the absolute level of stock. We're looking at that as a ratio to sales.
So you're relating it to the activity levels of the business. And what you don't really want to see is the stock built, stocks growing faster than sales. And that's for a number of reasons. The main reason is that generally, and it also depends what kind of stock, you know, stocks can take on different things. They can take on things like raw materials, work in progress, and finished goods, which is the main thing that you ought to be worried about. And obviously, if you have a growing pile of goods that you can't sell, eventually you have to turn them into cash because they lose value.
Mm-hmm.
And that loss of value, it gets reflected in your profits. It can blow a hole in your profits.
And presumably with a retailer where we're talking about fashion,
fashion,
things can go out of fashion very quickly. So it matters more in a retailer. If you see this in a retailer, turning that into cash might be harder because stuff has just simply become stuff that people don't want to buy anymore.
Yes, absolutely. So that for a retailer is, you know, retail analysts, investors, particularly at this time of year, because so many retailers make a lot of their money at Christmas. One of the key things that people focus on after the Christmas sales is how much stock have they got left.
Mm.
Because if they've got a lot of unsold stock, they worry about the hit to profits. You know, they might have to sell these things at a loss just to turn them into cash. And this is the whole thing. You know, when you invest in stock, you know, that is cash flowing out of the business. Now, if all things are going well, you sell that stock for more than it cost you and you make a profit. But if you can't sell it, danger is that you sell it for a loss and potentially a big loss, or even write it off completely because you can't sell it. And, you know, Ted Baker has always had pretty high levels of stock. It's been around sort of 25% of sales, even sort of 8-10 years ago. And in the last 3 or 4 years, that ratio has got bigger and bigger, and it's I think it was up to over 35% of sales.
Yeah, and actually you look at that graph, I mean, it's been steadily rising throughout the whole sort of 10, 12-year period.
Yeah.
But it seems to sort of
I think
be accelerating.
Obviously, you've got to take into account the type of business. You know, sometimes they had a big wholesaling business, and sometimes that can affect, you know, levels of stock that you might hold. And the other thing to bear in mind as well is that stock is an end of period figure, so end of 3 months, half year, or a year, generally a year. So it's a snapshot of what the stock levels were at that point in time, and you're comparing it with the revenues over a year.
But then we're looking back, you know, you've looked at it this week, and both you and Algie looked at it on the 26th of July. It's a trend.
Yeah.
So yeah, it might be a snapshot, but it's a snapshot that represents a trend.
Yeah, like anything, you need to look at the trend rather than 1 year in isolation to see if there is a pattern developing here.
Is this because it's tried to change the business, though? I mean, this was... When did I tip this? Maybe 2009. It was a tip of the year. It was absolutely brilliant, actually, for a while. For a long while.
As they are.
years and years. Things have obviously gone very bad there. And that was obviously, you know, the thing that obviously hit the share price very hard last year was the issue with the chief executive, which we won't talk about in any detail now.
No.
But they have tried to change the business. Have they essentially just got overambitious? Thought they were more than they were. It was a good UK retailer. Is it trying to be something else?
Yeah, that's a fair question to ask. Yeah, it could well be the case that they have tried to expand too quickly in the wrong areas and it's not worked. And it hasn't worked. We can see that through the trading. And you're left with too much stock.
I mean, it's quite interesting that actually, obviously, a big part of the business is wholesale.
Mm.
So not their own shops, but stuff they're selling into department stores. And department stores have had a horror of a year.
Yeah.
I mean, that must have hurt them really badly.
Oh, very much so. Yeah.
So I mean, Debenhams, House of Fraser. I mean, it's
a horror show.
Everything has gone wrong at the same time.
Yeah.
What else do you look at in this in your column this week? I mean, you look at Kia, which is another one we've had on the site for a very long time.
Kia. I mean, if we look at Kia, this is the one you look at and think, has no one learned the lessons from Carillion and Interserve? You know, Kia shares, you know, even at the start of this year were north of £10. They drifted down from sort of £14 a few years before, but still, you know, £10. You look at This is why studying the past is so important and looking at lots of different companies. And there were so many warning signs with this, particularly, you know, I mentioned this in my magazine column this week. You've got an inherently low profit margin business.
Because it's essentially a construction outsourcer.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about this kind of thing is that it's sold to investors as, you know, highly visible business, contracted revenues and that kind of thing. But as we've learned is that contracts are only good if you've signed them at the right price and you manage them well. But you have an inherently low profit margin business here. And unless you are someone like an Amazon or a Costco or a JD Weatherspoon, for example, that uses low margins as a source of customer value and sells more and generates profit by selling more rather than higher prices.
And they're genuinely quite predictable businesses. We know how many people are likely to go into a pub in any given year.
Yeah, then that can work well. In other businesses, a low profit margin can be a very big warning sign because it doesn't take much of a deterioration in trading for a low profit margin to become a no profit margin or even a zero negative profit margin. And then you start adding all, you know, layers of complexity onto this. So you start buying companies, big acquisitions followed by lots of bolt-on acquisitions, and you do it with debt and you load the business up with debt. The other thing as well, which I think is what did for Carillion and Interserve as well, is that, and this is the big lesson that's really investors should take away from these type of businesses, is that no one really knows what's happening with the cash flow. I mean, you've seen it with, you know, Galliford Try as well. And the cash flows of these contracts can be moving all over the place.
Why is that?
because you've got payments to suppliers and then you get payments for work done, so there's money moving around. You have to lay out for stuff and then you get paid.
Are they offering, you know, more generous payment terms perhaps to secure these contracts, which obviously affects the cash flow?
You could be. You know, you could be financing somebody else's business.
Yeah.
But, you know, you look at the cash balances of these businesses, and again, with a balance sheet, you can have a high cash balance, but it can be no way reflected of what the cash balance is throughout the year. And we've seen this with Carillion and Galliford Try, where the average net debt figures are a lot higher than the ones that they put on their balance sheet at the year end, where they dress it up and make it look as nice as possible.
Mm.
And the cash flow here was a real giveaway. I mean, if you look at the operating cash flow, so what you want to see is you want to see a business that says it's making a profit, you want to see that backed by cash. And with Kia, you could look over the last 5 years, so nothing, not even the last 12 months. Sometimes this was a business that produced no trading or operating cash flow, and yet it was saying it was making lots of profit. And often the operating cash flow was a lot less than the operating profit.
It's so weird. I mean, I was chatting to Algie about this.
Yeah.
You know, we've had three of these this week, but it feels like it's becoming more regular occurrence that we're seeing these accounting blow-ups. And you know, his view was that we're late in the cycle.
Yeah.
Companies are pushing harder to meet expectations and resorting to kind of this accounting trickery or, you know, financial engineering or whatever it might be to meet their numbers.
Yeah, I think what could well be going on here is a classic case of weak trading conditions finding these companies out. You know, when things are going well, quite often they can be ignored, or you get the strength of one side of the business that masks weakness elsewhere.
Or they might acquire to cover stuff up.
Yeah.
Everyone's happy with the acquisition because no one's really thinking that it's trying to disguise a problem.
Yeah, so you know, things like acquisitions, and you get the cost savings from the acquisitions that keep the profits ticking up. And then when the cost savings run out, you're there, you're standing there, and you're totally exposed. And this is the problem that we all have as outside investors. We don't have the same level of knowledge, and it can be very hard to spot these things, but with a little bit of work, you can pick up signs of things going wrong.
Theoretically, we have the same amount of knowledge as any investor, whether that be an institutional investor or anyone else, because disclosure rules say we should. And we do have the annual report.
Yeah, I'm not saying, I'm just comparing us with insiders.
Yeah, yeah.
So obviously, the insiders who know the management accounts and they know the business flows, obviously we wouldn't know that, and that's what makes it difficult.
But we do, as I say, have the annual report. And
yep.
And actually this, I think, is a much underrated document. Yeah, you know, we've said it time and time and time and time again.
Yeah.
Not enough people are using it properly.
No, and this all comes down to risk. This is about the management of risk, investors managing their risk by studying the business and the numbers that come from that business. Some people might think it's a bit of a dry exercise and a bit boring and something that they don't really want to do, but you ignore this kind of work at your peril. And, you know, as we've said many times, the annual report, freely available to everybody, the most valuable documents about a business that any investor can get their hands on. And for far too many people, private and professional investors, in my experience, just ignore it.
And I heard some stats recently, and I can't remember where or exactly what they were, but the stat essentially said hardly anybody is downloading annual reports these days.
No, I mean, you know, even analysts, you know, who are paid a lot of money, are not reading these documents. They rely an unbelievable amount on presentations, chatting with management, and that kind of thing. And it's amazing. It's not just bad stuff. You can pick up good stuff as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Green flags.
Yeah, you can pick up companies that are understating their profits, and or where there's some hidden asset value and that kind of thing.
Which is actually the Simon Thompson,
yeah,
exercise, the bargain shares exercise. He's looking for that stuff that's just not being valued properly by the market, and, or even the companies behind.
Yeah, and I think the reason why people don't do this is because it's actually hard work. I wouldn't say it was difficult, although, you know, I speak from the experience of having done it for over 20 years, but the more you do of this, there's plenty of literature out there to try and understand these kinds of things.
There's some books. Some guy in this room wrote some.
Yeah, there's books, that kind of thing. And just reading them, just reading the annual reports, and the more you read and the more different companies that you look at, you know, you'll pick up little things and think, right, I can take that. And I've seen that before and it meant that. And you see it again, you think, right, I know what that means this time.
Mm.
And it's immensely valuable.
I think you get a lot out of the tone that things are written in as well, whether that be an annual report or the statements that they put out through the RNS. You know, the tone tells you quite a lot as well. You know, there is an art to reading stuff. It needs practice.
It needs a lot of practice, but it's incredibly valuable and worthwhile.
Of course, the other big document that people perhaps don't pay much attention to is the prospectus, the IPO prospectus. And obviously your third example here being Aston Martin Lagonda. You looked at that prospectus before this came to market.
I actually wrote a piece in the magazine before it actually came to the market.
Nailed it, Phil. Nailed it.
And it was full of red flags. But no, you're absolutely right to say that if you are beginning to look at any company, and you know, if it's even if it's been listed for a few years, if you do a bit of digging on the internet or Company's House or places like that, or even just, you know, ring the company up or send the company an email, you can get hold of prospectuses. And these are not just for listing. You know, if a company has a rights issue,
yep,
you know, you will get... This is why companies don't want to do rights issues, because they have to issue a prospectus. And, you know, or if a company or a similar company in the same sector, might not be the company you're looking at, but say if a competitor floats or does a rights issue, get hold of the prospectus, because there's huge amounts of information about the business in there, both good and bad, because it's a legal document and they have to spell out the opportunities and the risks.
Mm.
And they are immensely, immensely valuable.
Of course, in the other document that all investors should read, not necessarily if they're investing in companies, but if they're investing in funds, is the fund documentation that's out there.
Yeah.
Which Tim Steer refers to in his book, The Signs Were There, which we both reference in our pieces this week.
Yeah, I can't recommend that book highly enough.
It's great, isn't it? It's really good.
It's probably for me one of the best books, if not the best practical book for investors that's been written for the last 20, 30 years.
I mean, it sort of sounds like it's very, you know, it's a negative approach. Like, you know, all these companies have done bad things and this is not the exciting, like, oh, I'm going to grow your wealth by X amount.
Well,
and I kind of find this quite interesting, though.
I think you have to avoid being too cynical.
Yes.
You have to have an optimistic bias to your way on life, I think, if you want to be a successful investor.
But there is this idea...
Unless you're a hedge fund shorting stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. But there is this idea that actually the first way to start making money is not to lose it, so...
Yeah, and it is, because, you know, the old simple bits of maths, you know, if a share falls 50%, it has to double to get back to where you were. And trying to recover from that kind of thing is incredibly hard. And usually... it doesn't happen.
Yeah, I think this red flag stuff is invaluable, which is why we've written on it so much. I mean, obviously this week, given what's been going on, but we wrote Algy, interviewed Tim Steer earlier in the year. Philip Ryden wrote a big piece on danger signs. We've been all over this.
Yeah, it's about protecting your hard-earned savings.
Absolutely.
As well as, you know, hopefully picking the right shares to make them grow.
Should we talk about a current... No red flags necessarily just yet. Well, he's putting a face over there. Okay, nothing's gone wrong. Nothing's falling off a cliff just yet. But we might be seeing some signs here that there's trouble. Cineworld.
Yeah, I mean, this is a company. And, you know, if you go back and look at companies that get into trouble, by far, I think the most common theme is big acquisitions funded with debt or partly funded with debt. And Cineworld a couple of years ago essentially has bet the company on the American cinema market by buying a business called called Regal, and paid a very high price for it, and loaded up with a lot of debt. I think it part financed it with asking shareholders for some money as well. And it needs this to pay off. You know, we see a lot of change going on in entertainment market. And I think, you know, we had this discussion before we just before we came on air. You know, you could have been bears of cinema chains 10 years ago.
You can always be bears of cinema chains. People watch telly.
Yeah.
People do other things.
But I think
and it's quite expensive.
It is. I mean, it's expensive. You know, you take a family of four to the cinema and it's not really that cheap.
No, it's not.
And, you know, if you look at the way that streaming is just getting better all the time now.
Well, I noticed you commenting on the new Amazon football offering this week.
Yeah, which I thought was actually pretty good.
Yeah, I've heard that a number of times, actually.
I was really impressed with it. You know, the picture quality, the coverage, they didn't try and be too clever with it. You know, we'll see, there's another round of matches tonight. Obviously, Arsenal playing tonight, so we'll see what happens there.
Yeah, I mean, we'll come back to this another time. This doesn't sound like good news for BT particularly, but there you go.
I don't know. It depends because, you know, you need the infrastructure for streaming. You know, you've got to, you need the bandwidth.
But Amazon have got it. Amazon have got the infrastructure. It's what they do. They are.
No, they haven't. They haven't got the.
They haven't?
No, Amazon don't own the bandwidth.
Right. Okay. The pipes.
So you need the pipes. So, you know,
Jeremy Corbyn's going to be giving it all to us for free.
Oh, yeah. Let's hope not. But we have a situation where, you know, things like both BT and Amazon are offering football, streaming football in 4K or ultra high definition. And you need about 20 megabits per second to stream that.
Mm.
And no one else to be on your internet at the same time. So you need this bandwidth to distribute the media, the entertainment, particularly live stuff. If you're going to go into sport.
Openreach, though, is essentially an independent company.
Yeah, I mean, it was potentially bullish for BT. If BT could get a financial settlement with the regulator, which is what it's arguing about at the moment, to get a decent return on fibre optic investment, fibre optic to the home.
Proper fibre optic.
Proper.
Not the fibre optic to the cabinet and a bit of copper thereafter.
That's correct, yeah. They've tried to do it on the cheap. And to be fair to BT, they've actually squeezed quite a lot of stuff out of the copper network, but I think it's gone as far as it can go now.
Indeed. Anyway, let's come back to BT another time.
Because we
were talking about Cineworld.
Yeah, so,
and I think this BT story, the Amazon story, is quite big actually, and I think we should come back to that.
It is a growing theme. Now, whether it stops people going to the cinema and people will get their big television sets and their sound systems, and ultimately though, I think the point I want to make about Cineworld is that it isn't really in control of its own destiny. It is dependent on filmmakers making enough good films that people can't wait to watch.
And, you know, and cinema chains have had a really good decade. And, you know, I think that good decade has been underpinned by Disney, or what's now a part of Disney, Marvel. I mean, it has been extraordinary what that's done for cinema attendance.
Yeah.
Extraordinary.
And the thing is that, and you know, no one ultimately knows this, but if the distribution capability is there through full fibre internet, what's to stop the filmmakers just cutting out the middlemen in the cinemas?
Well, Disney Plus has launched in America.
Yeah, so selling direct to the consumer,
mm.
and the consumer won't go to the cinema and watches it in their living room.
Yeah, yeah.
Now we're probably still away from that. But that is obviously the threat. And obviously one of the weaknesses that come out with Cineworld this week, it's saying, look, there hasn't been enough good films this year. And, you know, the revenues are down, you know, more than 10%, and they're down by about 13% in America, which is where and the only thing that's bailing them out is they're getting the cost savings from this acquisition.
But they can't continue indefinitely.
Exactly. They can't continue indefinitely. it's interesting now, the yield, the dividend yield on Cineworld shares is now 6%.
Ooh, getting into that danger zone.
Yeah, and it's either a buying opportunity or it's a red flag.
Mm. This was a great business.
Yeah.
This was a great business.
I mean, it's not become a diabolical business.
But it's just overstretched itself. It feels a bit like the Ted Baker scenario, you know? It's like, this was a great UK-focused business that wanted to be bigger.
They're under pressure to be bigger. You've got brokers who you know, they want the fees from debt issuance, equity issuance. You've got fund managers that want the earnings and the dividends to grow. This is why sometimes companies being listed on the stock exchange isn't in their best interest.
Well, this was the subject of our cover feature last week, that actually lots of companies are choosing not to do it, especially because they can get the money elsewhere. They don't need it.
Yeah. Well, you know, venture capital, private equity, even borrowing.
Mm. Should we talk about borrowing?
We can talk.
Cineworld, we're a bit... Okay, so anyway, to conclude on Cineworld, mind dry,
We'll see how we go here. You might get some respite. They seem to be quite bullish about the sort of the box office that's being lined up for next year. You've got James Bond coming in April and a few other things. They seem to be talking a bit... They seem to be a bit more upbeat.
Mm. I went to cinema once this year.
Yeah,
and it wasn't to see Joker.
I haven't been at all.
Yeah, I used to go a lot. There you go. I'm kind of.
But then again, I'm
you're a grumpy old sod.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's right. Pipe and slippers.
Let's talk about borrowing, because there's been some interesting developments on the debt front at Ocado.
I find
you really hate this.
I don't hate it.
Okay.
I just don't get it. Right, I don't get the valuation of this business. And you hear the bulls of this company telling about how great the technology is and how transformative it's going to be for the grocery industry. And I just say, well, hold on a minute. If it's that good, why can't Ocado make great returns out of it itself? And it seems to me that, you know, if you look across the whole world, selling groceries to people is a thin margin business. 2-3 pence in the pound profit margins or the dollar. And it seems to me that the bull case of Ocado is about selling some fancy technology, which I've no doubt is very good, into an industry where the economics are dire. And, you know, you have Kroger in America buying it. You've had a Japanese company this week buying it. I think, how are these companies going to make a return on their investment?
But is this why Ocado's doing well? Because these companies are suffering these dire economics. They're looking for a saviour and they're seeing it in Ocado.
But, you know, logistics and software, it's changing all the time. You know, Amazon's got some really good stuff, and we've not really seen Amazon really go at this market yet.
What, food?
Yeah. Not yet.
Yeah, I think it will.
I think it will.
It was bought Whole Foods, didn't it?
Yeah, and it's
and going, there's rumours about Morrison. Well, he's working with Morrison, and there's rumours that...
I think that Morrison's might end up getting bought by Amazon.
Yeah,
but what I'm saying is that, you know, you need to shift a lot of it at low margin to make the numbers stack up. And to me, the issue is this, is that the expectations that are baked into Ocado's share price are very, very high. And let's just demonstrate why I think this. So, as we talked, the share price is about £12.30. And that gives the market capitalization of the business of about £8.7 billion. Going back to our old friend, the annual reports again, if you take the time to read Ocado's annual report, in there is a very useful bit of information, and it is about the expected levels of profit they hope to make from the contracts that they'd signed. Now, that will have gone up a little bit, but as of last year, the actual total profit stream was going to be about $1.3 billion.
I remember you looking at this before.
Yeah, so this is not $1.3 billion in today's money. This is $1.3 billion over many, many years. And you've got a grocery business in the UK, which, okay, they sold half of it to Marks and Spencers for 750 million, which was a very frothy price. So let's say that the UK business, we'll give them the benefit of the doubt and say that the UK grocery business is worth $1.5 billion. Probably isn't, but let's say it is. And you've got an 8.7 billion market cap. We'll ignore the debt for just to keep it simple for our listeners, because that doesn't make a massive, it's not a massive part of the enterprise value or the asset value. So you've got 8.7, take away 1.5, you've got 7.2 of the value that's going towards the solutions business. And so you get 1.3 from this future profit, but that's not a present value. So where is this huge chunk of value going to come from that makes, and I think people have got carried away with this. I think you've had short sellers that have got burnt by it, who have bought back stock. There's not a natural seller in natural shorters now because they've been burnt. And you've got a lot of bulls talking about this being a technology stock. What type of industry this is, neither here nor there. This is all about the hard numbers. Are you going to get shed loads of cash flow coming back to you in 5 or 10 years' time? Or are you not? And that's the same for whether you're a grocer or a technology company. Just because you're a technology company doesn't mean that each pound of earnings should be worth more. It's all a function of growth.
Mm. It's a weird looking chart.
And
it's a weird looking chart. It goes nowhere for years and then just bosh.
Yeah. And I, you know, look at the forecast for Ocado. This company, no one's forecasting a profit over the next 3 years. In fact, the losses have been going up as they invest more in this, in these new contracts.
And now it's issued this, the convertible bond.
Well, for me, one of the best lessons I ever got taught when I was a young analyst, and this is going back 20 years, for Railtrack was a glamour stock in the late 90s. A lot of people got excited about the property value within Railtrack, and the share price went up and up and up. And it was wrong. People had misunderstood this, but that's by the by. And the shares went up to about, the shares floated at sort of £3 in, £3.60, I think, or £3.80 in 1996. And they went up to £17.50 or something by 1998, 1999. And Railtrack management decided to tap into the love affair with their equity to issue convertible bond. So they issued a bond borrowing money at a very cheap price and said, hey, look, we're not going to pay you the sort of rate of interest we would do, but hey, we're giving you a chance to buy into this rising share price that's going to continue for years ahead. I think, you know, the conversion price was sort of £18.50. I forget, but it was high. It was a premium to the share price. And I just remember a fund manager I was working with at the time just said, that's telling me that the management think that their share price is wildly overvalued. It was. And I think the same thing here is with Ocado, because if we look at the terms of this convertible, so they were going to raise £500 million. But because people are absolutely falling over themselves to get into this, it's gone up to 600 million. So they've issued a 600 million convertible bond, which expires in 6 years' time in 2025, the end of 2025. And the interest rate or the coupon on it is 0.87%.
Now that's attractive.
Almost as cheap as the government can borrow, right? And then, and of course, you sell it to selling it to myself. But hey, look, you can. We're going to give you the option to convert those bonds into shares, and the conversion price is £17.93, or 45% more than the current share price. And I just said, I think the current share price is very frothy, for what it's worth. I think. So in 6 years' time, I've got to believe that the share price is going to be even more frothy. When, don't forget, this analysts at the moment have still got this company making a post-tax loss in 2022, 3 years before the bond is due to mature. So I think this is a great sort of, it's not quite a red flag, but it's getting there. It's purple. And it's saying, look, management here have tapped into the euphoria amongst a very frothy share price and have used it to actually acquire very, very cheap borrowings. And they deserve a lot of credit for that. This is not me criticising Cardo management. I think they've done a brilliant job here, but I think the investment community needs to interpret it in a different way.
Do you know what? I actually don't understand really what it's doing. I know it's signing up these contracts. I don't really know how they work. I don't know what proportion of the global grocery market is going to go for this sort of stuff, what they're doing themselves. I've not read this anywhere. This sounds like we should look into it. I just don't get it. I just don't see what it's doing that either companies, grocers can't do themselves, or why it's so transformational for these guys and that they'll carry on paying throughout the years. I don't think enough research has been done here by anyone.
I think there's a lot of hope being built in here.
Mm.
Who's to say that in 2-3 years' time, another company might not come along with something that's even better?
Yeah, it might be. There is a company out there that might fit the bill. Is it Amazon?
Might be. I forget. There was another company that was mentioned the other day, and I forget what it was. But you know, you have this risk of technological change, technological obsolescence. And you know, it seems to me this is a classic example where no consideration of risk is being priced into the shares at all. So it's a blue sky scenario factored into the share price, and then you add a premium of that, and that's going to the moon.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's a weird one.
But at the moment, whilst the news flow is still positive, you won't see the share price come off. It's like anything. It's like, I think there was a discussion on Twitter yesterday, which I thought was really interesting. It's about short selling, and that, you know, good companies don't become victims of short sellers.
Oh, that was old John Stepek,
wasn't it?
Yeah,
John Stepek.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a very, very good question. He said, look, can somebody give me an example of a sound business that has been destroyed by short sellers? And there are none. And Ocado, for me, the catalyst for anything to become bad is high valuation can stay there for years. It's when the trading performance of the business turns.
Performance, but it's losing money.
Well,
what trading performance? It's losing money.
Well, the losses get bigger.
The losses get bigger.
But you see, which is what one of the things that I've said for a long time about what investors have, the two great things that investors have got. They know the current profit and they know the share price. Now, you're not always going to come up with the same answer, but the share price or the market capitalization is giving you a view of the expectations of future profits. And you can try and join the dots between where you are now and what the share price is assuming. I always think that investors shouldn't try and work out the value of a share. They should work out the expectations of the future that are baked into the share price and work out in their own mind whether they're too high or too low. And if they're too low, you buy. If you're too high, you don't buy or you sell. Mm. And this is a classic example for me where the expectations baked into this company are absolutely massive.
That's what I mean, though, about the research. What is it assuming? How many grocers is it assuming will come onto its platform or it will be providing services to? How much shopping will actually go online?
Yeah, I mean...
And because actually people do still go to the shops, to the supermarket.
They do. And the thing is that I think when I wrote about this, maybe one of my alpha reports sometime the last year, my view is that Ocado was always going to have to come back for more money because the debt's going up and, you know, the profits aren't there to pay the interest on the debt. So what it's done here is effectively avoided a rights issue. This is smart because, you know, there will be people who will say, well, you know, 600 million of convertible bonds, what will the dilution be if this bond converts into shares?
But no one cares because the price will be through the moon.
Either that or it's not going to convert because the share price will never get to £17.93.
I don't like it.
But you've got to ask yourself, what happens to Ocado in 6 years' time when their 600 million bond becomes due? Is it going to, you know, how's it, if the profits haven't come through, it's still going to have to try and find 600 million to pay it back.
Yeah.
that probably won't concern most of our listeners.
Indeed. It's very interesting. It's very interesting. It's more observational at the moment, I would say. I wouldn't buy these shares.
I wouldn't buy these shares. I know people have made a lot of money out of them, and fair play.
Well, of course they have, but they didn't make a lot of money for a long, long time. And this has happened. This has only happened in the last sort of year and a half. So it's a weird story. I wouldn't buy the shares. I don't see a business here that delivers money, and that's it.
Let's face it. The people who are telling people to buy the shares, their own forecasts are not saying where the money is.
No. Red flag. We've talked enough about red flags.
Maybe.
Anyway, thanks, Phil. Let me just talk you through what else we've got in the mag. Results sort of wind down a bit, thank goodness, as we go into our hideous, hideous Christmas production period. Mm. Always takes a shine off Christmas, producing the Investors Chronicle. But there you go. There you go. Sector focus this week is great. One of the best headlines I've seen in the mag for a while. The Great Snout Rout. It's a look at Asian swine flu. Well done, Nelushi, for headline of the year. Lots in the personal finance and funds section that they will be talking about on their podcast this week. Not least, the return of the Portfolio Clinic by popular demand. And that will be a feature for a while going forward. And Dave Baxter has had a look at investment trusts and where they're trading in terms of discounts, which is really useful. Lovely context. Lots of news, lots of comments, including your excellent column this week. Bear Boy is looking at the election, but it's useful. It's interesting, but I'm so bored with politics. Bored with politics, Phil?
I am, yeah.
Going to get out and soil your ballot paper? Soil or spoil?
I think it's a distinct possibility.
lots of interesting news. As I've mentioned, some of the big red flaggy accounting stories of the week, Saatchi and Stobart, Ocado's in there as well. And we talk about supermarkets and actually plastic, which is obviously a big issue for them. Really quite interesting. Plastic is a crazy, crazy thing that's going on. And Saudi Aramco going public. Wow. I mean, there's one giant red flag. But there you go. Anyway, thanks again, Phil. And thanks everyone for listening. The cover feature this week is actually looking at another scandal, Neil Woodford. A little bit of a retrospective, but what can we learn from this and what investors need to do to make sure that they don't fall foul of possibly another Woodford? And actually, we had a fund suspension this week, M&G Property Portfolio. So this is a real risk.
I think people are rolling their eyes on this property thing. You know, saying, why are these property funds still in open-ended funds where you can be asked to redeem your investors' cash and you can't sell the asset?
The liquidity mismatch. And I think there's more out of it than actually people are thinking there is.
Yeah, there is.
So, Fallen Angels, the lessons private investors should learn from the Woodford scandal and how you can avoid getting stuck in something like that again. Pick it up in all good news agents, £4.99, or get on the website and subscribe. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back again next week.